This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Critics of Donald Trump are really concerned about his nomination of Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State, a man who they say is too cozy with Russia. What might happen under a Trump administration if the relationship between the United States and Russia warms up? This is a situation with the potential to significantly alter the geopolitical landscape for a lot of nations. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about it. The devastating civil war in Syria is getting a lot of press for obvious reasons, but the civil war in Yemen is getting worse and worse, and we don't want to forget about this situation. It's a very important picture of the larger battle for supremacy in the Middle East taking place between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Anthony Chibatawe about the situation, that how this got to where it is today, why it's happening, looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. In our third segment, we're going to talk about alcohol. You may have heard that alcohol is bad for you and that it's good for you. It increases your risk of disease and it can lower your risk of cancer and Alzheimer's disease. Well, what's the truth? It turns out there's truth in all of that. It just depends on how much you're drinking. We're going to talk to nutritionist Jörg Mardian about how alcohol affects your health. And I'll conclude the program with a few words about how to make sure you're accomplishing the important things in your life. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. There are a lot of people who are accusing Donald Trump of being too close with Russia, even allegations that the Russians helped Mr. Trump win the American presidential election. These concerns were amplified when President-elect Trump selected his nominee for Secretary of State, ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson. This is a man who's done a lot of business with Russia. He even received Russia's Order of Friendship from Vladimir Putin himself. So how much of the concern is just the anti-Trump group looking for something to criticize, and how much is truly a matter of concern? If America's ties with Russia do improve, how is that going to affect global geopolitics? To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be here.
So let's start by talking about Rex Tillerson. What has he done with Russia that gives people cause for concern?
Right. Well, Rex Tillerson, he's the CEO of ExxonMobil, which by many measures is the largest oil company in the world. And he's been the CEO for many years. And mostly that is what he's famous for, is the deals he's negotiated with foreign nations for oil exploration, in particular, Russia. I remember reading back in 2011 about just really a very groundbreaking deal he negotiated with Russia, which gave Rosneft, the Russian state-owned oil company, some minority stakes in some of the Exxon's projects in Texas and in the Gulf of Mexico, in return for Exxon getting a joint partnership in the Arctic Ocean. The Arctic Ocean is one of the really big unexplored oil reserves left on the planet. So it was actually a really good, pretty good deal for Exxon. Looks like they were going to make a lot of money off that. Although after Putin then ended up invading Ukraine and annexing Crimea, that deal was suspended as part of the sanctions. And so I think Exxon was losing about $1 billion of lost revenue a year off not being able to continue with that deal. So Rex Tillerson, he's definitely been, and you can kind of see how his thought process would lead him to that conclusion, a big critic of the sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine.
So he's really looking at this primarily from an economic standpoint.
Right. It'd be a business angle, as they figured, like, well, if we can lift these sanctions, then I can resume my company can resume its business deals with Russia, we'll be able to get back more drilling in the Ukraine, and it will probably help both the Russian and the U.S. economy. Probably help the Russian economy quite a bit more, just due to the fact that the oil sector is less than contributes less than 2% to America's gross domestic product, while it contributes 16% to Russia's gross domestic product. Actually, I think because a lot of these oil companies are state-owned in Russia, they're also getting like 50% of federal government revenues come from oil revenues. Mm-hmm. Russia's a petrostate. So he is right in that lifting these sanctions would probably help the American economy some, especially the American oil sector, or help the Russian economy a lot more. The concern is that all these things are probably legitimate concerns for the CEO of an oil company to have. But then when, like Trump did, when you appoint that CEO or nominate that CEO, he still needs Senate confirmation to a Secretary of State position. You're like, how much of the business interest is going to carry over? And I was reading in a New York Times editorial this morning where they had a foreign policy analyst really kind of predicting that, like, the appointment of Rex Tillerson does show that American foreign policy might be moving more towards a very pragmatic, business-minded angle as opposed to a very, like, ideological, human rights-minded angle, which would, if you lifted sanctions on Ukraine, that's what it would be, is you'd
sanctions on Russia for having invaded Ukraine.
Yes, I guess the Ukrainian sanctions, but yeah, the sanctions against the Putin regime for annexing Crimea is, from a human rights standpoint, you basically throw Ukraine under the bus. You just admit that Crimea is part of Russia, and you strengthen Russia to potentially, even there's still a civil war in a couple other provinces in eastern Ukraine with Russian-backed militias.
Yeah, well, this definitely seems to the whole tenor of the way that Donald Trump has been talking about Russia definitely seems aimed at undermining that sense of stigma associated with Russia. It's minimizing the seriousness of the moves that Vladimir Putin has made and kind of creating this moral equivalency. Well, yeah, they kill people, but we kill people too, that kind of thing. And the Rex Tillerson nomination is very much in line with that way of thinking, isn't it?
Right. And it's not, definitely not an isolated case. Obviously, the Trump administration hasn't been sworn in yet, so this is still really just kind of predicting what his foreign policy will be like based on his political nominations. But even we've talked on this program before about the situation in Taiwan, where when he first called, he received a call from the president of Taiwan. And when I first heard he did that, I was actually really kind of respected that. I was like, well, he's standing up for a democracy against a dictatorship. But then the week afterwards, he was saying, is like, well, maybe we can put Taiwan on the bargaining table so that if I can negotiate an economic deal with China, that will be the deciding factor on whether I recognize Taiwan as part of China or not.
Right.
Ukraine's really similar. Trump hasn't Rex Tillerson's definitely said he wants sanctions lifted. Trump hasn't committed either way. He just says that it's something his administration will be looking at. But the tone is very much that, like, well, if I can get a good oil deal in the Arctic, maybe I'll just assume that Crimea is part of Russia. If not, then maybe I'll stick up for them. It's not like an ideology of that I'm going to defend these people's human rights. Mm-hmm. It's more just like Putin's a businessman. I'm a businessman. Rex Tillerson's a businessman. Let's see what sort of deal we can work out that will benefit our economies.
Right. And it definitely, those Russians who may have been heartened by the kind of rhetoric that they heard from Donald Trump during the campaign had to have been that much more so having seen Rex Tillerson nominated for this position. Now, this is the way that Donald Trump is, it seems to be ready to conduct himself with the Putin administration. In a sense, this has been going on. Vladimir Putin has had dealings with Russian or with American presidents for a while now, where it seems like every American president kind of comes into office in the with the thinking that they're going to be able to have good relations with Vladimir Putin, only to end up realizing that they were played.
Right. Putin does seem to be a master of the reset, because he came to power at the very beginning of the year 2000. And so at that time, Bill Clinton was going out of the presidential office. George Bush was coming in. Both of them seemed pretty optimistic about this brand new Russian leader that they didn't know much about. He was the head of the Secret Service before that. So by definition, he wasn't really supposed to be in the limelight.
Right.
Because
His background with the FSB was known.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely known that he was him. He was the director of it. So they knew he was the director of the FSB, which was the successor of the KGB. He wouldn't be someone you'd have seen like in weekly news headlines in America and Russia, maybe. But, you know, Bill Clinton, when he came in, he definitely wished him the best. And he said, he's like, well, Yeltsin brought freedom to Russia, and now Putin's going to bring prosperity and the rule of law. Then George Bush had a year later his very famous comment that they've teased him for ever since, that I looked deep into Putin's eyes and got a sense of his soul and saw that a man that I could trust. Mm-hmm. But then 8 years later, he invaded Georgia. And so George Bush learned the hard way that you cannot trust Vladimir Putin. And tensions were very high between Russia and the United States in 2008. Until Barack Obama was elected, and he kind of took the standpoint, it's like, well, Putin and George Bush aren't getting along, but no one really gets along with George Bush. But now that I'm a president, mm-hmm. we'll have a reset. So we actually sent Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State with a real life yellow box with a red button on it. There's like a real reset button that they could, the Russian foreign minister at the time could push, and relations were reset. So relations are good now, until about 6 years later, Putin invaded Ukraine. And then Barack Obama learned the exact same lesson that George Bush learned, that you cannot trust Vladimir Putin. And there have been sanctions on them since then. And a lot of conservatives at the time were complaining that the sanctions weren't strict enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has hurt Russia's oil sector a little bit.
And it doesn't seem to have had enough of an impact on their actual dealings. It's not changing their foreign policy.
Right. No, the foreign policy is the same. It's just they've put some sanctions on Russia that have depressed its economy a little bit.
And the Russians are notoriously adept at handling that kind of privation.
Right. It has hurt their economy some, but like I said, the Russians have definitely experienced much worse in the past century. So it takes a lot to get to them. Mm-hmm.
So this is interesting to see. In a sense, it does feel like Donald Trump is kind of treading the same ground that these other men have, except that he has kind of a uniquely high estimation of his own ability to handle this kind of dealing situation with Vladimir Putin.
Because on the one half, you can almost give George Bush a little bit of a free pass in that maybe he was kind of naive with his reset, but it was a brand new Russian leader. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could see why they'd have some hope that he'd be different. Now with the Trump administration, I mean, we've done been fooled twice. You'd think you'd kind of pick up on this, but Donald Trump, he's the man who wrote The Art of the Deal. Mm-hmm. And so he assumes that he's the best deal maker there is. And so he can figure, it's like, well, I'll just deal with the Putin regime. And he's made campaign promises that he's like said, well, he said, if I can get a good deal from him, maybe I'll let him keep Crimea. But he's like said, he won't go into the rest of Ukraine. He's like, he said, I can promise you that. He's like, you can write that down. He will not go into the rest of Ukraine. And I guess there's quite a bit of confidence in his deal-making, a similar level of confidence that I'm sure George Bush and Barack Obama had at one point in their life. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's very interesting to just consider what sort of ramifications this might have going forward. If this all unfolds the way that it's looking like it will, where Vladimir Putin essentially takes this as a green light to be able to do more, pursue his aims more, and if cash begins to flood back into his nation, if sanctions are lifted, this would give him a freer hand to pursue his foreign policy goals, you would presume. Whether or not that happens, there still have to be people in a lot of other nations who are very concerned about Russian adventurism, who have to be pretty nervous right now and would be trying to recalculate how they're supposed to proceed given the realities of a Trump presidency.
Right, because like I mentioned earlier, I think this some of these deals that Rex Tillerson has put forward may actually benefit the U.S. economy, at least in the short term. But we're several thousand miles away from Russia. Mm-hmm. Now, it's probably going to benefit the Russian economy even more, considering this is a sector of their kind that's 16% of the gross domestic product. So if their GDP starts going up, they've got more money they can spend on their military. So their military will be strengthened. And those people living in Ukraine and the Baltics and Finland and Poland and the Czech Republic, anyone in Eastern Europe's going to be really, really worried about this. And
This is the kind of dynamic that we've seen playing out here really ever since that invasion of Georgia. That was 2008, was it not?
Right.
And where you've seen a lot of fear among Eastern Europeans, especially who suffered under the boot of the Soviet incursion during the Cold War. And it's driving them into the arms of the European Union. Germany is having to recalculate based on Russia's rising power.
Right, because right after Barack Obama's reset in 2008, the very next year they were trying to sign the Lisbon Treaty, more colloquially known as the EU Constitution. And I know the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic didn't want to sign, but because of that reset, the Obama administration nixed a missile defense shield in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. To not antagonize the Russians, which the Czechs really wanted that missile defense shield as for their own security. And he ended up signing that Lisbon Treaty, and they asked him why he had such a change of heart. And he's like, well, I'm trying to summarize this comment here, but he said, it looks like America's abandoned us. It's better to kiss the German chancellor than hug the Russian bear.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really saw that. I mean, Czechoslovakia really got on board with the European Union because he saw that the Obama administration had abandoned him and figured, he's like, well, I don't really want to surrender my sovereignty to Angela Merkel in Germany, but she's nicer than the Russians are.
Yeah.
So I'll go for that. And you could really see something like this with you start lifting sanctions on the sanctions against Russia, and that would open up some oil deals for the United States, maybe give our economy a temporary boost. But all these Eastern European nations are going to have to realize that we need a new superpower to protect us, because it's not going to be America doing it anymore.
We really should expect a lot of prophetically significant trends to accelerate based on what we see happening right now. Trump administration coming into power, and Russia benefiting. If sanctions are lifted, if it goes the way that it's looking like it could go, this could really accelerate quite a few of these trends. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Russia, about its dealings with the Trump administration in the future. He's writing an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
There's a lot of attention focused on the mess in Syria, where civil war has displaced more than half of the country's population. It's killed about 400,000 people. But there is another civil war taking place in the region that isn't getting nearly as much attention, but it's turning into quite a terrible conflict. This war has serious ramifications for the future of the Middle East in general. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Anthony Chibadewe with us. Hello, Anthony.
Hello.
So tell us, what is happening there? We've discussed it a few times on this program, but how bad is the war getting there?
So far, up to 10,000 people have been killed in this conflict in Yemen, and more than 500 of them have been children. 37,000 people have been injured. 182,000 people have fled to neighboring countries, and 2 million have been displaced internally. That's a tragedy. That's a serious crisis that's developing in Yemen.
Yeah, easy to be overlooked when you look at the numbers in neighboring Syria, but in a nation the size of Yemen, this is a huge amount of the population that's being affected by that.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Some stats tell us that about 80% of the nation's population needs health services. That's 21 million people, and 7.4 million of those are children. And this war in Yemen has devastated most of those health facilities. And you have people who are saying that this Yemen is on the brink of the abyss because of this crisis that we're seeing here. So it's a disaster. And too bad that Syria is a little worse right now, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a crisis in Yemen. It's another crisis that's actually beginning to catch up to Syria.
You see, you've written an article, it's on thetrumpet.com right now, called The Middle East's Forgotten Civil War. I think it gives a lot of really helpful background and telling us how did Yemen end up in a situation, the situation that it's in right now. Maybe you could just give us that background and tell us how we got to this point.
Yes, what's happening in Yemen is simply a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. These two nations are at war. It's a proxy war, but it's still a war. And they've been at it for at least 5 years. They've been fighting in Pakistan, in Central Asia, in Iraq, in Lebanon, and of course, most significantly, in Syria and in Yemen. Now, in Syria and Yemen, there's a full-scale war, and it's because of this proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. In Syria, Iran is supporting the current government, and Saudi Arabia is supporting the rebel groups. But in Yemen, it's the other way around. So clearly what we can see just from that is that this is not about democracy. It's not about supporting the leader in power. It's not about that for either one of these countries. It's about regional supremacy. These two countries are fighting for regional supremacy. That's why they don't care whether they are supporting the government or supporting the rebel groups. Now, in Yemen, Iran, unfortunately, has been winning and Saudi Arabia has been losing. In Yemen, Iran is supporting the Houthis, the Houthi rebel group. That's the group that Iran has been supporting. And in September 2014, these Houthi rebels managed to seize the capital city. They took over the capital city, and that's a huge, huge victory. In Iran, at that time, you had Iranian officials bragging that they just secured yet another Middle Eastern capital. A few months later, in January, they forced the resignation of the government there and took over the presidential palace and placed the president under house arrest. Now, the president fled just a little after that, and then he fled to a different city, and then he called for help from Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, we can give this to them. They are pretty capable of forming alliances, forming coalitions with its fellow Sunni states who feel just as threatened by Iran. They are pretty good at this. They've been doing this a lot of times, just forming coalitions very quickly. And that's what they did. And in March 2005, they assembled a coalition that involved Egypt, Morocco, Jordan, Sudan, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Qatar and Bahrain. They teamed up with Saudi Arabia to help to intervene in Yemen, and the United States also joined that effort. But even though this coalition has been able to slow down the Houthis a little bit, they have failed to take over the capital city. Mm-hmm. They have failed to take the city from the Houthis, and they have also made significant errors that now threaten the whole intervention effort.
Yeah, well, tell us about that. These recent, but this is just, we're talking about in the last 2 or 3 months where they've done some things that have really provoked a lot of ire among Yemenis and other nations as well, including those in this Sunni alliance that you're talking about.
Yes, sir. In early October, the coalition bombed a funeral ceremony in the capital city. That bombing killed 140 civilians and injured more than 500 others. That was a huge humanitarian and political disaster for the Saudi Arabians. And it wasn't even the only time that Saudi Arabia and its coalition has been accused of attacking civilians. It wasn't the first time, but this was the worst humanitarian attack against civilians in Yemen. And it was committed by Saudi Arabia. The United Nations condemned it. It said it was horrendous and heinous. Human Rights Watch called it a war crime. Mm-hmm. And even the United States was upset by that. And it actually, the United States has been helping out this effort, providing a lot of assistance, especially with the airstrikes. And the United States said that, hey, Saudi Arabia, our support is not a blank check. Mm-hmm. And they say we are actually going to reduce the funding that we have been giving you and the support that we have been giving you because of this error.
Now, this is really interesting. The United States, having supported the Saudi effort to check Iran's taking control of Yemen, and there are other factors involved here, but for them to, this seemed like it was in some ways kind of a turning point where the United States became, took a softer approach to the Houthis, and it seemed to kind of change the dynamic.
Oh, definitely it did. In fact, the United States made some deals with the Houthis, you know, just like the United States has been dealing with Iran. These Houthis are sponsored by Iran, and following that funeral bombing, the United States government made some deal with the Houthi rebels. I think the Houthi rebels had kidnapped an American citizen, and the United States wanted that American citizen to be released by the Houthis. And in exchange, the United States airlifted some of the people injured in that attack. They airlifted them and flew them to Oman to receive medical attention. So, yeah, the United States has actually been cozying up to the Houthis, and at the same time, they are condemning Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't necessarily say we are switching allegiance, but they are reducing the support to Saudi Arabia in an effort that has failed to take over the capital back from these Iranian-sponsored Houthi rebels. So things are not going well for that coalition, and Iran is just going to continue funding those rebels. So this really is a game changer.
So we've looked at this situation a lot over the last few years in terms of this kind of serving as somewhat of a gauge of Iran's the spread of its influence and power within the Middle East. We talk about, just in terms of biblical prophecy, Iran being the king of the south, that this is the most important power in the region. We also talk about this alternative power, Saudi Arabian led or supported coalition of anti-Iranian forces. So what we see in Yemen is really a very pointed illustration of this battle for supremacy between these two powers. And there's really, maybe you could just help us to understand what Iran's purpose is here. What is Iran's larger goal, and why would Yemen be a part of that?
Yes, as you said, there's this clash between these two powers in the region, and if you look at a map, you can see how Saudi Arabia controls quite a good portion of the region, especially around the Red Sea area, and Iran has a strong foothold in that area. And if Iran gets to control that, it can control a lot of the movement of oil in the region. That gives Iran tremendous power. It already has a lot of that power in the Persian Gulf, and it would want to have similar power in the Red Sea area. And if you also look at Syria, it's also trying to get as far as the Mediterranean Sea. So that's a lot of influence. Iran probably sees that. It could lose in Syria, but regardless of that, they are trying whatever they can. It's an all-out battle for control, for regional supremacy. And if Iran gets control of that Red Sea area, it threatens more than just Saudi Arabia. It threatens the whole world.
If you look at this article that Anthony wrote online at thetrumpet.com, it's called The Middle East's Forgotten Civil War. He goes back and quotes an article by the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, April 2015, Iran gets a stranglehold on the Middle East. And Gerald Fleury talks about how the Houthis' takeover of Yemen was not just a grassroots revolution. It was part of a deliberate and calculated Iranian strategy to conquer the Red Sea. He says the Houthi takeover in Yemen proves that Iran is implementing a bold strategy to conquer the vital sea lane from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. We need to understand the gravity of this new situation in Yemen. I think this article by Mr. Chabadirway gives some great background, really taking us all the way back to when the Houthis first came to prominence back in 2004, and traces their rise up through the time in between, bringing us up to speed with what's happening right now. Really excellent article. I would encourage all of our listeners to go online and read that at thetrumpet.com. This is good stuff, Anthony. We appreciate you coming in and sharing that with us, the research that you've done to understand the full situation of what's happening there, and for talking to us about it.
Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
An apple a day keeps the doctor away, but what about a glass of wine? Maybe you've heard what seems like conflicting information. Some say alcohol is beneficial. There's also information showing how it increases the risk of disease. How does alcohol affect your health? And is there a level where it's safe to consume, or is it better to just abstain altogether, as some experts recommend? To talk about this, we have nutritionist Jorg Mardian via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
Hi there.
Let's just start by talking about some of the negative effects that alcohol can have on your body.
All right. Alcohol has sort of a two-faced link with health. Both as a tonic and as a poison. So depending on what study you look at, but there is a 2014 global drug survey that involved a lot of people, and it said alcohol is the most widely used substance in the world. So keeping that in context, there's a lot of abuse with alcohol, and it has, of course, staggering social and economic consequences. So as an example, in the U.S. alone, there's 100,000 lives lost a year due to excessive alcohol drinking. So it's also a factor in homicides and suicides and traffic accidents, which factor in. And you can also look at justice court fees, medical bills, lost productivity, and other costs. And they add up to just about a $250 billion price tag annually.
So this is the problems of people who they're drinking too much. It's affecting their judgment. They're doing things that they wouldn't be doing otherwise. These are obviously problems. What about just the health of the individual, how it impacts people's health? I guess that 100,000 people that you're talking about specifically health-related ramifications of alcohol consumption or alcohol overuse.
Well, That's right. And a lot of, you know, when we look at alcohol overuse, even people who say they don't drink a lot, they might drink just one or two more. And that can be a tipping point in an accident. It can be a tipping point in a social situation. So there's a lot of ramifications when we look at the social price tag on the economy. It's not just rampant drunken behavior, walking and staggering in the streets. So there's a lot of costs that come with that. And we really have to look at how it affects our health and how it affects the economy as well. So there is a, you know, there's a way to look at alcohol that would be a safe consumption level that we could discuss.
What happens in the body when we drink alcohol? Maybe if you're talking about different levels and there's kind of a threshold, if you cross the threshold, you start getting into the negative effects of it. But I'm guessing that if you don't cross that threshold, that you're actually getting some benefits from it.
Oh, of course there's benefits. I mean, there's a lot of valid research. I mean, decades worth of research that shows moderate alcohol consumption is good for us, and they have compelling health benefits. We can look at red wine, for instance. It has powerful ingredients that fight inflammation, blood clots, oxidation, helps with your cholesterol levels, and lowers risk of heart disease. But that's when the experts talk about a level of drinking that would be considered in moderation, a drink or two. Going outside of that, of course, then you would tip the scales towards the other way. So nutritionally, there's a lot of nutrients in alcohol as well, especially in wine that they're finding, and that's where those benefits come from. Let's talk about the brain as well. We know that frequent intoxication can do a lot of damage to the brain. That's well studied, but moderate drinking seems to have a protective effect. So there's a study in a journal of neuropsychiatric disease and treatment. It shows moderate drinkers have a 23% less likely chance to develop Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia and cognitive decline. So that's staying within that one to two drinks that we talk about. And just recently I heard that, you know, there's such a fine line between what is moderate drinking and what goes over that. So having more than even a drink more than the moderate amount, they say you can actually tip the scales then and going into the opposite direction towards ill health.
Well, that's really interesting. So this is really another instance among several where essentially science is proving what the Bible says true. Because the Bible, there are quite a few verses that talk about alcohol consumption. There are places where it specifically mentions health-giving properties to it. I think the Apostle Paul talked to Timothy and told him, yeah, take a little bit of wine for your stomach's sake. And there are other verses that are very strongly condemning of abuse. And they're saying, you know, you really can get into problems if you overuse it. But there's clearly, there's that tipping point is kind of implied in there.
Oh, the science correlates beautifully with the Bible. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And, you know, that would be a reliable source to look upon first. And, you know, between the Old Testament and the New Testament, I mean, like you said, there's tons of verses that talk about a moderate use. And it also talks about in 1 Timothy 5:23 about the medicinal purpose of alcohol, having a little bit for the stomach's sake, right? So, and those are within that amount that would be good for us. But then again, you know, alcohol is very powerful. And then God does condemn the drunkenness part that comes with it and all the associated evils with that.
Well, let's get into maybe some more details about what happens at certain levels. You talked about the, say, with respect to the brain, that it has a protective effect. And then if you go past the tipping point, then it has a damaging effect. Are there other, say, physical ramifications that come from different alcohol consumption levels?
You're talking about the ill effects now?
Any. I guess what's in front of that tipping point and what's on the other side of it?
Right. So yeah, there's a lot of effects. A lot of today, what we suffer from is inflammation, and alcohol does help with inflammation of the body in those amounts. The big one, as I discussed, is the heart. So we do want to have a protective effect for the heart. And the American Cancer Society had a big study on that, and they said there's antioxidants in red wine. And this is crucial to understand. It actually induces cell death in certain types of cancer.
It kills off cancer. Is that what you're saying? Or it causes
in
cancer?
Types of cancer, yes. Which is, that's staggering.
Huh.
And so this is the Canadian Cancer Society. This isn't a Mickey Mouse operation. So they said if you're drinking this in moderate amounts, this has a very positive, a good positive effect on preventative, using prevention for cancer as well as killing off certain cancer cells.
Oh, that's amazing. There have been other studies that have said that, I guess this is beyond that tipping point, that alcohol can actually cause cancer. Is that right?
Yes. There's the rub right there. And I just listened to an expert on a radio the other day, and it just enthralled me. And he said, is it conflicting? He says, why are we hearing one side of the coin and the other? He says, the message isn't really clear, is it? He says, we're saying there's some good effects. We're saying there's bad effects. What is that tipping point? And he said, really, the tipping point is looking at what is a standard drink and having a couple of drinks there to get the good effects. He said, but the problem is people don't understand the tipping point, and they don't understand how quickly we go past that point into ill health.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it's actually fairly precise, and that's where they're finding all these conflicting reports.
Okay, so I guess we're kind of getting to the nub of this. How do you know if you're hitting that tipping point? And you've been saying one or two drinks. Probably a lot of people would tend to think in terms of, well, how do I feel? Would that be an accurate measure?
Yeah, it is. There's blood alcohol levels. Of course, we don't take them. I mean, with a drink or two, you're going to feel slightly euphoric. Your conversation gets better. It just makes for a great social adjunct. I mean, we all know that. You have a great dinner, and if you have it with food, it's always better because it absorbs so much slower. So that's a great way to have a dinner with people, and that's a good way to have it. The problem is metabolizing the alcohol. It takes a while for your liver to do its job. So at a certain rate that you can absorb that, you go over that, and you can quickly get into a car, and then you can breathe into a breathalyzer and they'll say you're over. So we have to understand always that the first two drinks are, they make for a good conversation. That third drink an hour already, you're starting to go over the line. So you have to realize that there has to be some willpower involved and just pull back from that. If you're between 0.01 and 0.1, there's a mild euphoria, and you start to have some coordination and attention problems. If you get at 0.1 and 0.2, then you start to get those biological disturbances, which depress areas of the brain. So you have speech and vision and reaction time problems. And then over that, of course, 0.2 to 0.3, you get coordination problems, confusion. And beyond that, you can even go into coma and death as you drink more and more. And of course, there's just no moderation as we go up in the blood alcohol levels there.
Basically, if you stick to one or two drinks, you should be fine. Or is that actually, it seems like for one person that might be just fine. For another person, that might be too much. It seems like it hits different people differently.
Well, that has a lot to do with your body size. If I'm a big guy, I can absorb a little more alcohol than, say, somebody half my size. Even the difference between a man and a woman is different. That's why they actually say, the experts, a woman should have less to drink than a man. They actually say one drink a day for a woman. And that's just what the studies are saying right now. And I looked into it pretty deeply. So we absorb at a different level the alcohol that we drink. So we have to be careful. But again, we should stick to the standards rather than saying, well, I'm a big guy, I can do three or four drinks before I feel it. By the time you start to feel it, if you're going four drinks and you're drinking quickly, it may be too late. You're already over that tipping point, right? Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't go by how we feel, but we should go by what is actual moderation and what the experts say is moderation, which is a drink or two.
Okay, well, that seems like a pretty easy to follow practical advice on what to do with all of this scientific data that you've studied into. One last question that I have is just, what about the quality of the alcohol that you're drinking? I would imagine that there would be, well, maybe a difference between something like wine versus something like hard alcohol, but also just what the ingredients are in that alcohol. You know, whether you're drinking, say, an organic wine or different types of beers, something that would be produced by a huge brewery versus a micro brewery that's aiming for higher quality. What are your thoughts about that?
Exactly. There is a standard. When I look at a wine, I usually reach for an organic wine just because you have unsavory ingredients that you just don't want to get into with the traditional wines. Say with a beer itself, I don't drink a lot of North American beer. There's just too many chemicals in them. I'll drink a European beer, which is brewed according to a certain standard. And a lot of the breweries around here are starting to take that standard in as well. They just won't do it with the chemicals. I'm not as versed on the hard liquor. I just don't drink any hard liquor. But beer, I'll make sure that it is the European standard without the chemicals. And the wine, if I don't get the organic, I'll get a headache. So I'm just going to go and say that's because, you know, there's ingredients in there that the chemicals that aren't that are reacting with me. And we also want to look at there's a quality of organics. If we get a lot of pesticides and that, you know, what does that do to the absorption of the nutrients that are in the grapes as well? You know, the chemicals are playing havoc with our body. And we're really trying to take in alcohol as like a food. We're trying to make sure that it feeds us something. It's not just what we feel, but what are the nutrients doing to our body? So we don't want to make sure that the chemicals are absent from that and it does our body some good.
Interesting stuff. We've been talking with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about alcohol and its effects on our body and our health. He's working on an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Jörg, cheers.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
What if somehow you learned that you would die in a week? If you were given just 7 days to think back over your life, what would be your assessment? How satisfied would you be with what you accomplished? What would you regret having left undone? Are you really spending your life on something that makes a difference? Are the truly important matters getting enough of your attention? What draws you away from those things? What could you trim or push aside or cut out? Moses was contemplating these kind of questions when he wrote Psalm 90. He wrote, "We spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away." And then he drew this conclusion, and it's really beseeching God. He said, "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." When you recognize just how brief life is, you gain sharp clarity of thinking. Just look at yourself. Honestly evaluate, how are you using your days, your hours, and your minutes? Are you just marking time, or are you truly numbering your days so you can apply your heart to wisdom? Are you devoting energy and effort to the significant things? Are you prodding yourself, aiming high, in order to truly use your life and fulfill your God-given potential? A successful life demands being purposeful and driven. Your time is your most valuable asset, and you don't even know how much or little you have. All you know for sure is that supply is limited. The devil knows your time is limited. He built modern society specifically to consume your attention with trivialities, to swallow your time, to draw you away from what matters. If you just do what comes naturally, what comes easiest, you're going to be swept up in a torrent of distraction that takes you far away from anywhere you want to be. Don't get trapped in trivial, quickly forgotten busyness. You have to establish your priorities and then trudge toward them step by step against resistance daily, hourly, regularly evaluate what you're doing and make sure that you're heading in the right direction. Don't let your priorities fade and disappear and then replace them with new priorities that you also let fade and disappear. Once you establish your priorities, sprint, lumber, clamber, scrap, fight, and crawl toward them until you have achieved them. Look at your daily tasks and ask yourself tough questions about each one. Is this really important? How will this further a long-term goal? How much impact will this have that will last beyond this week or this month? What's going to have the most long-term significance? Does this really fit with and advance my real purpose in life? Is it just diffusing my energy and preventing me from accomplishing what I need to? If so, can I delegate it or can I cut it out completely? Always aim to devote as much time as possible to work of lasting value. Focus on what's really important. Focus is what's going to determine your success in achieving those important things more than anything else. If you can't focus on something, you won't accomplish it. If you can, you will. For fruit trees to reach their maximum yield, they have to be regularly pruned. And Jesus Christ said, growth in your life also requires continually pruning what isn't producing. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, the Father takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes so that it may bear more fruit, he said in John 15. Unwanted, unhelpful growth, that's natural. Extra obligations, diversions, projects, preoccupations, these bud and blossom all the time. And that's why pruning is so critical and why it has to be continual. At any moment, stop and ask yourself, what am I doing right now? Is this really what I need to be doing? And evaluate it by the fruit. Is what you're doing producing good results, meaningful results? Are they building your family? Are they helping others? Are they advancing God's work and God's cause? You can't afford to waste time. You've got to prune anything that is stealing your minutes and not contributing to what you produce. In order to focus on the important things, the less you think about other things, the better. So set limits on what you consume and do. Eliminate the unessential. Cross off what's not really important. Postpone things that don't really need to be done right away. Keep your focus locked in on what's really important and prune everything else. This is a continual process. You have to prune, then prune again, and then again. You got to do it monthly, weekly, even daily. This is how to maximize your time and energy. If you're doing something important, you're moving in the right direction, even if it's happening slowly. As Earl Nightingale said, never give up on a dream just because of the time it will take to accomplish it. The time will pass anyway. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibatterway, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Henry David Thoreau. Our life is frittered away by detail. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I say, let your affairs be as 2 or 3, not 100 or 1,000. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.